I think it was exactly a week after our last swim that the noon mail brought a reply from the second Miss Phelan. The lady wrote she had just returned to St. Algebra from her sister's funeral. Euphemia had never been the same after breaking that hip. As to the matter of Mrs. Humbert's daughter, she wished to report that it was too late to enrol her this year, but that she, the surviving Phelan, was practically certain that if Mr. and Mrs. Humbert brought Dolores over in January, her admittance might be arranged. Next day, after lunch, I went to see our doctor, a friendly fellow whose perfect bedside manner and complete reliance on a few patented drugs adequately masked his ignorance of and indifference to medical science. The fact that Lowe would have to come back to Ramsdale was a treasure of anticipation. For this event, I wanted to be fully prepared. I had, in fact, begun my campaign earlier, before Charlotte made that cruel decision of hers. I had to be sure when my lovely child arrived, that very night and then night after night, until St. Algebra took her away from me, I would possess the means of putting two creatures to sleep so thoroughly that neither sound nor touch should rouse them. Throughout most of July I had been experimenting with various sleeping powders, trying them out on Charlotte, a great taker of pills. The last dose I had given her, she thought it was a tablet of mild bromides to anoint her nerves, had knocked her out for 4 solid hours. I had put the radio at full blast. I had blazed in her face an olisbos-like flashlight. I had pushed her, pinched her, prodded her, and nothing had disturbed the rhythm of her calm and powerful breathing. However, when I had done such a simple thing as kiss her, she had awakened at once as fresh and strong as an octopus. I barely escaped. This would not do, I thought. Had to get something still safer. At first, Dr. Byron did not seem to believe me when I said his last prescription was no match for my insomnia. He suggested I try again, and for a moment diverted my attention by showing me photographs of his family. He had a fascinating child at Dolly's age, but I saw through his tricks and insisted he prescribe the mightiest pill extant. He suggested I play golf, but finally agreed to give me something that he said would really work. And going to a cabinet, he produced a vial of violet-blue capsules, banded with dark purple at one end, which, he said, had just been placed on the market and were intended not for neurotics, whom a draught of water could calm if properly administered, but only for great sleepless artists who had to die for a few hours in order to live for centuries. I love to fool doctors, and though inwardly rejoicing, pocketed the pills with a sceptical shrug. Incidentally, I had had to be careful with him. Once, in another connection, a stupid lapse on my part made me mention my last sanatorium, and I thought I saw the tips of his ears twitch. Being not at all keen for Charlotte or anybody else to know that period of my past, I had hastily explained that I had once done some research among the insane for a novel. But no matter. The old rogue certainly had a sweet girline. I left in great spirits. Steering my wife's car with one finger, I contentedly rolled homeward. Ramsdale had, after all, lots of charm. The cicada's word, the avenue had been freshly watered. Smoothly, almost silkily, I turned down into our steep little street. Everything was somehow so right that day, so blue and green. I knew the sun shone because my ignition key was reflected in the windshield. And I knew it was exactly 3:30 because the nurse who came to massage Miss Opposite every afternoon was tripping down the narrow sidewalk in her white stockings and shoes. As usual, Junk's hysterical setter attacked me as I rolled downhill, and as usual, the local paper was lying on the porch where it had just been hurled by Kenny. The day before, I had ended the regime of aloofness I had imposed upon myself, and now uttered a cheerful homecoming call as I opened the door of the living room. With her cream-white nape and bronze bun to me, wearing the yellow blouse and maroon slacks she had on when I first met her, Charlotte sat at the corner bureau writing a letter. My hand still on the doorknob, I repeated my hearty cry. Her writing hand stopped. She sat still for a moment. Then she slowly turned in her chair and rested her elbow on its curved back. Her face, disfigured by her emotion, was not a pretty sight as she stared at my legs and said, "The Hayes woman, the big bitch, the old cat, the obnoxious mama, the old stupid Hayes is no longer your dupe. My fair accuser stopped, swallowing her venom and her tears. Whatever Humbert said or attempted to say is inessential. she went on. "You're a monster. You're a detestable, abominable criminal fraud. If you come near, I'll scream out the window. Get back." Again, whatever H.H. murmured may be omitted, I think. "I'm leaving tonight. This is all yours. Only you'll never, never see that miserable brat again. Get out of this room." Reader, I did. I went up to the ex-semi-studio. Arms akimbo, I stood for a moment quite still and self-composed, surveying from the threshold the raped little table with its open drawer, a key hanging from the lock, four other household keys on the tabletop. I walked across the landing into the Humberts' bedroom and calmly removed my diary from under her pillow into my pocket. Then I started to walk downstairs, but stopped halfway. She was talking on the telephone, which happened to be plugged just outside the door of the living room. I wanted to hear what she was saying. She cancelled an order for something or other and returned to the parlour. I rearranged my respiration and went through the hallway to the kitchen. There, I opened a bottle of scotch. She could never resist scotch. Then I walked into the dining room and from there, through the half-open door, contemplated Charlotte's broad back. "You're ruining my life and yours," I said quietly. "Let us be civilized people." "It is all your hallucination. You're crazy, Charlotte. The notes you found were fragments of a novel. Your name and hers were put in by mere chance, just because they came in handy. Don't think it over. I shall bring you a drink." She neither answered nor turned, but went on writing in a scorched scrawl whatever she was writing. A third letter, presumably. Two in stamped envelopes were already laid out on the desk. I went back to the kitchen. I set out two glasses, to St. Algebra, to Lowe, and opened the refrigerator. It roared at me viciously while I removed the ice from its heart. Rewrite. Let her read it again. She will not recall details. Change. Forge. Write a fragment and show it to her, or leave it lying around. Why do faucets sometimes whine so horribly? A horrible situation, really. The little pillow-shaped blocks of ice. Pillows for polar teddy bear, though, emitted rasping, crackling, tortured sounds as the warm water loosened them in their cells. I bumped down the glasses side by side. I poured in the whiskey and a dram of soda. She had tabooed my pin. Bark and bang went the icebox. Carrying the glasses, I walked through the dining room and spoke through the parlour door, which was a fraction ajar, not quite space enough for my elbow. "I've made you a drink," I said. She didn't answer, the mad bitch, and I placed the glasses on the sideboard near the telephone, which had started to ring.
"Leslie speaking. Leslie Thompson," said Leslie Thompson, who favoured a dip at dawn. "Mrs. Humbert, sir, has been run over, and you'd better come quick."
I answered, perhaps a bit testily, that my wife was safe and sound, and still holding the receiver, I pushed open the door and said, "There's this man saying you've been killed, Charlotte." But there was no Charlotte in the living room. I rushed out. The far side of our steep little street presented a peculiar sight. A big, black, glossy Packard had climbed Miss Opposite's sloping lawn at an angle from the sidewalk, where a tartan lap robe had dropped in a heap, and stood there, shining in the sun, its doors open like wings, its front wheels deep in evergreen shrubbery. To the anatomical right of this car, on the trim turf of the lawn slope, an old gentleman with a white moustache, well-dressed, double-breasted grey suit, polka-dotted bow tie, lay supine, his long legs together, like a death-size wax figure. I have to put the impact of an instantaneous vision into a sequence of words. Their physical accumulation in the page impairs the actual flash, the sharp unity of impression. Rug heap car, old man doll, Miss O's nurse running with a rustle, half-empty tumbler in her hand, back to the screened porch, where the propped-up, imprisoned, decrepit lady herself may be imagined screeching, but not loud enough to drown the rhythmical yaps of the junk setter walking from group to group, from a bunch of neighbours already collected on the sidewalk, near the bit of checked stuff, and back to the car which he had finally run to earth, and then to another group on the lawn consisting of Leslie, two policemen, and a sturdy man with tortoiseshell glasses.
At this point, I should explain that the prompt appearance of the patrolman, hardly more than a minute after the accident, was due to their having been ticketing the illegally parked cars in a cross lane two blocks down the grade, that the fellow with the glasses was Frederick Beale Jr., driver of the Packard, that his 79-year-old father, whom the nurse had just watered on the green bank where he lay, a banked banker, so to speak, was not in a dead faint, but was comfortably and methodically recovering from a mild heart attack or its possibility. And finally, that the laprobe on the sidewalk, where she had so often pointed out to me with disapproval the crooked green cracks, concealed the mangled remains of Charlotte Humbert, who had been knocked down and dragged several feet by the Beale car as she was hurrying across the street to drop three letters in the mailbox at the corner of Miss Opposite's lawn. These were picked up and handed to me by a pretty child in a dirty pink frock, and I got rid of them by clawing them to fragments in my trouser pocket. Three doctors and the Farlows presently arrived on the scene and took over. The widower, a man of exceptional self-control, neither wept nor raved. He staggered a bit, that he did, but he opened his mouth only to impart such information or issue such directions as were strictly necessary in connection with the identification, examination and disposal of a dead woman, the top of her head a porridge of bone, brains, bronze hair and blood. The sun was still a blinding red when he was put to bed in Dolly's room by his two friends, Gentle John and the dewy-eyed Jean, who, to be near, retired to the Humberts' bedroom for the night, which, for all I know, they may not have spent as innocently as the solemnity of the occasion required. I have no reason to dwell in this very special memoir on the pre-funeral formalities which had to be attended to, or on the funeral itself, which was as quiet as the marriage had been. But a few incidents pertaining to those 4 or 5 days after Charlotte's simple death have to be noted. My first night of widowhood, I was so drunk that I slept as soundly as the child who had slept in that bed. Next morning, I hastened to inspect the fragments of letters in my pocket. They had got too thoroughly mixed up to be sorted into three complete sets. I assumed that, "And you had better find it because I cannot buy," came from a letter to Lowe, and other fragments seemed to point to Charlotte's intention of fleeing with Lowe to Parkington or even back to Piskey, lest the vulture snatch her precious lamb. Other tatters and shreds, never had I thought I had such strong talons, obviously referred to an application not to St. A, but to another boarding school which was said to be so harsh and grey and gaunt in its methods, although supplying croquet under the elms, as to have earned the nickname of Reformatory for Young Ladies. Finally, the third epistle was obviously addressed to me. I made out such items as, "After a year of separation we may," "Oh, my dearest, oh, my," "Worse than if it had been a woman you kept," or "Maybe I shall die," but on the whole, my gleanings made little sense. The various fragments of those three hasty missives were as jumbled in the palms of my hands as their elements had been in poor Charlotte's head. That day, John had to see a customer, and Jean had to feed her dogs, so I was to be deprived temporarily of my friend's company. The dear people were afraid I might commit suicide if left alone, and since no other friends were available, Miss Opposite was incommunicado, the McCoos were busy building a new house miles away, and the Chatfields had been recently called to Maine by some family trouble of their own, Leslie and Louise were commissioned to keep me company under the pretense of helping me to sort out and pack a multitude of orphan things. In a moment of superb inspiration, I showed the kind and credulous Farlows, we were waiting for Leslie to come for his paid tryst with Louise, a little photograph of Charlotte I had found among her affairs. From a boulder she smiled through blown hair. It had been taken in April 1934, a memorable spring. While on a business visit to the States, I had had occasion to spend several months in Piskey. We met, and had a mad love affair. I was married, alas, and she was engaged to Hayes. But after I returned to Europe, we corresponded through a friend, now dead. Jean whispered she had heard some rumours, and looked at the snapshot, and still looking, handed it to John, and John removed his pipe and looked at lovely and fast Charlotte Becker, and handed it back to me. Then they left for a few hours. Happy Louise was gurgling and scolding her swain in the basement. Hardly had the Farlows gone than a blue-chinned cleric called. and I tried to make the interview as brief as was consistent with neither hurting his feelings nor arousing his doubts. Yes, I would devote all my life to the child's welfare. Here, incidentally, was a little cross that Charlotte Becker had given me when we were both young. I had a female cousin, a respectable spinster in New York. There we would find a good private school for Dolly. Oh, what a crafty Humbert! For the benefit of Leslie and Louise, who might, and did, report it to John and Jean, I made a tremendously loud and beautifully enacted long-distance call and simulated a conversation with Shirley Holmes. When John and Jean returned, I completely took them in by telling them in a deliberately wild and confused mutter that Lowe had gone with an intermediate group on a 5-day hike and could not be reached. "Good Lord," said Jean, "what should we do?" John said it was perfectly simple. He would get the Climax police to find the hikers. It would not take them an hour. In fact, he knew the country, and... "Look," he continued, "why don't I drive there right now, and you may sleep with Jean?" He did not really add that, but Jean supported his offer so passionately that it might have been implied. I broke down. I pleaded with John to let things remain as they were. I said I could not bear to have the child all around me, sobbing, clinging to me. She was so high-strung. The experience might react on her future. Psychiatrists have analysed such cases. There was a sudden pause. "Well, you are the doctor," said John a little bluntly. "But after all, I was Charlotte's friend and adviser. One would like to know what you are going to do about the child anyway."
"John," cried Jean, "she is his child, not Harold Hayes's. Don't you understand? Humbert is Dolly's real father."
"I see," said John. "I'm sorry, yes, I see. I didn't realize that. It simplifies matters, of course. And whatever you feel is right."
The distraught father went on to say he would go and fetch his delicate daughter immediately after the funeral, and would do his best to give her a good time in totally different surroundings, perhaps a trip to New Mexico or California. Granted, of course, he lived. So artistically did I impersonate the calm of ultimate despair, the hush before some crazy outburst, that the perfect Farlows removed me to their house. They had a good cellar, as cellars go in this country, and that was helpful, for I feared insomnia and a ghost. Now I must explain my reasons for keeping Dolores away. Naturally, at first, when Charlotte had just been eliminated and I re-entered the house a free father and gulped down the 2 whiskey and sodas I had prepared and topped them with a pint or 2 of my pin and went to the bathroom to get away from neighbours and friends, there was but one thing in my mind and pulse, namely the awareness that a few hours hence, warm, brown-haired and mine, 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 Lolita would be in my arms, shedding tears that I would kiss away faster than they could well. But as I stood wide-eyed and flushed before the mirror, John Farlow tenderly tapped to inquire if I was okay, and I immediately realized it would be madness on my part to have her in the house with all those busybodies milling around and scheming to take her away from me. Indeed, unpredictable Lo herself might, who knows, show some foolish distrust of me, a sudden repugnance, vague fear and the like, and gone would be the magic prize at the very instant of triumph. Speaking of busybodies, I had another visitor, friend Beale, the fellow who eliminated my wife. Stodgy and solemn, looking like a kind of assistant executioner with his bulldog jowls, small black eyes, thickly rimmed glasses and conspicuous nostrils, he was ushered in by John, who then left us, closing the door upon us with the utmost tact. Suavely saying he had twins in my stepdaughter's class, my grotesque visitor unrolled a large diagram he had made of the accident. It was, as my stepdaughter would have put it, a beaut, with all kinds of impressive arrows and dotted lines in varicoloured inks. Mrs. H.H.'s trajectory was illustrated at several points by a series of those little outline figures, doll-like wee career girl, or whack, used in statistics as visual aids. Very clearly and conclusively, this route came into contact with a boldly traced sinuous line representing 2 consecutive swerves, one which the Beale car made to avoid the junk dog, dog not shown, and the second, a kind of exaggerated continuation of the first, meant to avert the tragedy. A very black cross indicated the spot where the trim little outline figure had at last come to rest on the sidewalk. I looked for a similar mark to denote the place on the embankment where my visitor's huge wax father had reclined, but there was none. That gentleman, however, had signed the document as a witness underneath the name of Leslie Thompson, Miss Opposite, and a few other people. With his hummingbird pencil deftly and delicately flying from one point to another, Frederick demonstrated his absolute innocence and the recklessness of my wife. While he was in the act of avoiding the dog, she had slipped on the freshly watered asphalt and plunged forwards, whereas she should have flung herself not forward but backward. Fred showed how by a jerk of his padded shoulder. I said it was certainly not his fault, and the inquest upheld my view. Breathing violently through jet-black tense nostrils, he shook his head and my hand. Then, with an air of perfect savoir-vivre and gentlemanly generosity, he offered to pay the funeral home expenses. He expected me to refuse his offer. With a drunken sob of gratitude, I accepted it. This took him aback. Slowly, incredulously, he repeated what he had said. I thanked him again, even more profusely than before. In result of that weird interview, the numbness of my soul was for a moment resolved, and no wonder. I had actually seen the agent of fate. I had palpated the very flesh of fate and its padded shoulder. A brilliant and monstrous mutation had suddenly taken place, and here was the instrument. Within the intricacies of the pattern, hurrying housewife, slippery pavement, a pest of a dog, steep grade, big car, baboon at its wheel, I could dimly distinguish my own vile contribution. Had I not been such a fool or such an intuitive genius to preserve that journal, fluids produced by vindictive anger and hot shame would not have blinded Charlotte in her dash to the mailbox. And even had they blinded her, still nothing might have happened, had not precise fate, that synchronizing phantom, mixed within its alembic the car and the dog and the sun and the shade and the wet and the weak and the strong and the stone. Adieu, Marlena. Fat Fate's formal handshake, as reproduced by Beale before leaving the room, brought me out of my torpor, and I wept. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I wept. The elms and the poplars were turning their ruffled backs to a sudden onslaught of wind, and a black thunderhead loomed above Ramsdale's white church tower when I looked around me for the last time. For unknown adventures, I was leaving the livid house where I had rented a room only 10 weeks before. The shades, thrifty, practical bamboo shades, were already down. On porches or in the house, their rich textures lend modern drama. The house of heaven must seem pretty bare after that. A raindrop fell on my knuckles. I went back into the house for something or other while John was putting my bags into the car. And then a funny thing happened. I do not know if in these tragic notes I have sufficiently stressed the peculiar sending effect that the writer's good looks, pseudo-Celtic, attractively simian, boyishly manly, had on women of every age and environment. Of course, such announcements made in the first person may sound ridiculous. But every once in a while I have to remind the reader of my appearance, much as a professional novelist who has given a character of his some mannerism or a dog has to go on producing that dog or that mannerism every time the character crops up in the course of the book. There may be more to it in the present case. My gloomy good looks should be kept in the mind's eye if my story is to be properly understood. Pubescent Lo swooned to Humbert's charm, as she did to hiccupy music. Adult Lotta loved me with a mature, possessive passion that I now deplore and respect more than I can say. Jean Farlow, who was 31 and absolutely neurotic, had also apparently developed a strong liking for me. She was handsome in a carved Indian sort of way, with a burnt sienna complexion. Her lips were like large crimson polyps, and when she emitted her special barking laugh, she showed her dull teeth and pale gums. She was very tall, wore either slacks or sandals or billowing skirts with ballet slippers, drank any strong liquor in any amount, had had 2 miscarriages, wrote stories about animals, painted, as the reader knows, lake scapes, was already nursing the cancer that was to kill her at 33, and was hopelessly unattractive to me. Judge, then, of my alarm when, a few seconds before I left, she and I stood in the hallway, Jean, with her always trembling fingers, took me by the temples and, tears in her bright blue eyes, attempted, unsuccessfully, to glue herself to my lips. "Take care of yourself," she said. "Kiss your daughter for me." A clap of thunder reverberated through the house, and she added, "Perhaps, somewhere, some day, at a less miserable time, we may see each other again." Jean, whatever wherever you are, in minus time-space or plus soul-time, forgive me all this, parenthesis included. And presently I was shaking hands with both of them in the street, the sloping street, and everything was whirling and flying before the approaching white deluge, and a truck with a mattress from Philadelphia was confidently rolling down to an empty house, and dust was running and writhing over the exact slab of stone where Charlotte, when they lifted the laprobe for me, had been revealed, curled up, her eyes intact, their black lashes still wet, matted, like yours, Lolita. One might suppose that with all blocks removed and a prospect of delirious and unlimited delights before me, I would have mentally sunk back, heaving a sigh of delicious relief. Eh bien, pas de tout. Instead of basking in the beams of smiling chance, I was obsessed by all sorts of purely ethical doubts and fears. For instance, might it not surprise people that Lo was so consistently debarred from attending festive and funeral functions in her immediate family? You remember, we had not had her at our wedding. Or another thing, granted it was the long, hairy arm of coincidence that had reached out to remove an innocent woman, might coincidence not ignore in a heathen moment what its twin lamb had done and hand Lo a premature note of commiseration? True, the accident had been reported only by the Ramsdale Journal, not by the Parkington Recorder or the Climax Herald, Camp Q being in another state and local deaths having no federal news interest. But I could not help fancying that somehow Dolly Hayes had been informed already, and that at the very time I was on my way to fetch her, she was being driven to Ramsdale by friends unknown to me. Still more disquieting than all these conjectures and worries was the fact that Humbert Humbert, a brand new American citizen of obscure European origin, had taken no steps toward becoming the legal guardian of his dead wife's daughter, 12 years and 7 months old. Would I ever dare take those steps? I could not repress a shiver whenever I imagined my nudity hemmed in by mysterious statutes in the merciless glare of the common law. My scheme was a marvel of primitive art. I would whiz over to Camp Q, tell Lolita her mother was about to undergo a major operation at an invented hospital, and then keep moving with my sleepy nymphette from inn to inn while her mother got better and better and finally died. But as I travelled campward, my anxiety grew. I could not bear to think I might not find Lolita there, or find instead another scared Lolita, clamouring for some family friend. Not the Farlows, thank God, she hardly knew them, but might there not be other people I'd not reckoned with? Finally, I decided to make the long-distance call I had simulated so well a few days before. It was raining hard when I pulled up in a muddy suburb of Parkington, just before the fork, one prong of which bypassed the city and led to the highway which crossed the hills to Lake Climax and Camp Q. I flipped off the ignition and for quite a minute sat in the car, bracing myself for that telephone call and staring at the rain, at the inundated sidewalk, at a hydrant. A hideous thing, really, painted a thick silver and red, extending the red stumps of its arms to be varnished by the rain, which, like stylized blood, dripped upon its argent chains. No wonder that stopping beside those nightmare cripples is taboo. I drove up to a gasoline station. A surprise awaited me when at last the coins had satisfactorily clanked down and a voice was allowed to answer mine. Holmes, the camp mistress, informed me that Dolly had gone Monday, this was Wednesday, on a hike in the hills with her group and was expected to return rather late today. Would I care to come tomorrow? And what was exactly, without going into details, I said that her mother was hospitalised, that the situation was grave, that the child should not be told it was grave, and that she should be ready to leave with me tomorrow afternoon. The two voices parted in an explosion of warmth and goodwill, and through some freak mechanical flaw, all my coins came tumbling back to me with a hitting-the-jackpot clatter that almost made me laugh, despite the disappointment at having to postpone bliss. One wonders if this sudden discharge, this spasmodic refund, was not correlated somehow in the mind of McFate with my having invented that little expedition before ever learning of it as I did now. What next? I proceeded to the business centre of Parkington, and devoted the whole afternoon, the weather had cleared, the wet town was like silver and glass, to buying beautiful things for Lo. goodness, what crazy purchases were prompted by the poignant predilection Humbert had in those days for check weaves, bright cottons, frills, puffed-out short sleeves, soft pleats, snug-fitting bodices, and generously full skirts. Oh, Lolita, you are my girl, as V was Poe's and B Dante's, and what little girl would not like to whirl in a circular skirt and scanties? Did I have something special in mind, coaxing voices asked me? Swimming suits? We have them in all shades. Dream pink, frosted aqua, glands mauve, tulip red, ooh-la-la black. What about play suits? Slips? No slips. Lo and I loathed slips. One of my guides in these matters was an anthropometric entry made by her mother on Lo's 12th birthday. The reader remembers that Know Your Child book. I had the feeling that Charlotte, moved by obscure motives of envy and dislike, had added an inch here, a pound there. But since the nymphette had no doubt grown somewhat in the last 7 months, I thought I could safely accept most of those January measurements. Hip girth, 29 inches. Thigh girth, just below the gluteal sulcus, 17. Calf girth and neck circumference, 11. Chest circumference, 27. Upper arm girth, 8. Waist, 23. Stature, 57 inches. Weight, 78 pounds. Figure, linear. Intelligence quotient, 121. Vermiform appendix present. Thank God. Apart from measurements, I could, of course, visualize Lolita with hallucinational lucidity, and nursing as I did a tingle on my breastbone at the exact spot her silky top had come level once or twice with my heart, and feeling as I did her warm weight in my lap, so that in a sense I was always with Lolita as a woman is with child, I was not surprised to discover later that my computation had been more or less correct. Having, moreover, studied a midsummer sale book, it was with a very knowing air that I examined various pretty articles, sport shoes, sneakers, pumps of crushed kid for crushed kids. The painted girl in black who attended to all these poignant needs of mine turned parental scholarship and precise description into commercial euphemisms, such as petite. Another, much older woman in a white dress with a pancake makeup seemed to be oddly impressed by my knowledge of junior fashions. Perhaps I had a midget for mistress. So, when shown a skirt with two cute pockets in front, I intentionally put a naive male question and was rewarded by a smiling demonstration of the way the zipper worked in the back of the skirt. I had next great fun with all kinds of shorts and briefs. Phantom little Lolitas dancing, falling, daisying all over the counter. We rounded up the deal with some prime cotton pajamas in popular butcher boy style. Humbert, the popular butcher. There is a touch of the mythological and the enchanted in those large stores where, according to ads, a career girl can get a complete desk-to-date wardrobe, and where little sister can dream of the day when her wool jersey will make the boys in the back row of the classroom drool. Life-size plastic figures of snub-nosed children with dun-coloured, greenish, brown-dotted, fawnish faces floated around me. I realized I was the only shopper in that rather eerie place, where I moved about fish-like in a glaucous aquarium. I sensed strange thoughts form in the minds of the languid ladies that escorted me from counter to counter, from rock ledge to seaweed, and the belts and the bracelets I chose seemed to fall from siren hands into transparent water. I bought an elegant valise, had my purchases put into it, and repaired to the nearest hotel, well pleased with my day. When the dessert was plunked down, a huge wedge of cherry pie for the young lady and vanilla ice cream for her protector, most of which she expeditiously added to her pie, I produced a small vial containing Papa's purple pills. As I look back at those seasick murals, at that strange and monstrous moment, I can only explain my behaviour then by the mechanism of that dream vacuum wherein revolves a deranged mind. But at the time it all seemed quite simple and inevitable to me. I glanced around, satisfied myself that the last diner had left, removed the stopper, and with the utmost deliberation tipped the filter into my palm. I had carefully rehearsed before a mirror the gesture of clapping my empty hand to my open mouth and swallowing a fictitious pill. As I expected, she pounced upon the vial with its plump, beautifully coloured capsules loaded with beauty's sleep. "Blue!" she exclaimed. "Violet blue! What are they made of?" "Summer skies," I said, "and plums and figs and the great blood of emperors." "No, seriously, please." "Oh, just purpills. Vitamin X. Makes one strong as an ox or an axe. Want to try one?" Lolita stretched out her hand, nodding vigorously. I had hoped the drug would work fast. It certainly did. She had had a long day. She had gone rowing in the morning with Barbara, whose sister was waterfront director, as the adorable, accessible nymphette now started to tell me, in between suppressed, palate-humping yawns, growing in volume. Oh, how fast the magic potion worked, and had been active in other ways, too. The movie that had vaguely loomed in her mind was, of course, by the time we water-treaded out of the dining room, forgotten. As we stood in the elevator, she leaned against me, faintly smiling.
"Wouldn't you like me to tell you?"
half-closing her dark-lidded eyes.
"Sleepy, huh?"
said Uncle Tom, who was bringing up the quiet Franco-Irish gentleman and his daughter, as well as two withered women, experts in roses. They looked with sympathy at my frail, tanned, tottering, dazed rose-darling. I had almost to carry her into our room. There she sat down on the edge of the bed, swaying a little, speaking in dove-dull, long-drawn tones.
"If I tell you... if I tell you, will you promise?"
Sleepy, so sleepy, head lolling, eyes going out.
"Promise you won't make complaints."
"Later, Lo. Now go to bed. I'll leave you here, and you go to bed. Give you 10 minutes.
"Oh, I've been such a disgusting girl,"
she went on, shaking her hair, removing with slow fingers a velvet hair ribbon.
"Let me tell you..."
"Tomorrow, Lo. Go to bed. Go... to bed, for goodness sake, to bed." I pocketed the key and walked downstairs. Gentlewomen of the jury, bear with me. Allow me to take just a tiny bit of your precious time. So this was le grand moment. I had left my Lolita still sitting on the edge of the abysmal bed, drowsily raising her foot, fumbling at her shoelaces, and showing as she did so the nether side of her thigh up to the crotch of her panties. She had always been singularly absent-minded, or shameless, or both, in matters of leg show. This, then, was the hermetic vision of her which I had locked in, after satisfying myself that the door carried no inside bolt. The key, with its numbered dangler of carved wood, became forthwith the weighty sesame to a rapturous and formidable future. It was mine. It was part of my hot, hairy fist. In a few minutes, say 20, say half an hour, sicker ist sicker, as my Uncle Gustav used to say, I would let myself into that 342 and find my nymphette, my beauty and bride, imprisoned in her crystal sleep. Jurors, if my happiness could have talked, it would have filled that genteel hotel with a deafening roar. And my only regret today is that I did not quietly deposit key 342 at the office and leave the town, the country, the continent, the hemisphere, indeed the globe, that very same night. Somehow, in connection with that quiet, poetical afternoon of fastidious shopping, I recalled the hotel or inn with the seductive name of the Enchanted Hunters, which Charlotte had happened to mention shortly before my liberation. With the help of a guidebook, I located it in the secluded town of Briceland, a 4-hour drive from Lowe's camp. I could have telephoned, but fearing my voice might go out of control and lapse into coy croaks of broken English, I decided to send a wire ordering a room with twin beds for the next night. What a comic, clumsy, wavering Prince Charming I was. How some of my readers will laugh at me when I tell them the trouble I had with the wording of my telegram. What should I put? Humbert and daughter? Homburg and small daughter? Homburg and immature girl? Homburg and child? The droll mistake, the G at the end, which eventually came through, may have been a telepathic echo of these hesitations of mine. And then, in the velvet of a summer night, my broodings over the filter I had with me. Oh, miserly Hamburg! Was he not a very enchanted hunter as he deliberated with himself over his boxful of magic ammunition? To rout the monster of insomnia, should he try himself one of those amethyst capsules? There were 40 of them, all told. 40 nights with a frail little sleeper at my throbbing side. Could I rob myself of one such night in order to sleep? Certainly not. Much too precious was each tiny plum, each microscopic planetarium with its live stardust. Oh, let me be mawkish for the nonce. I'm so tired of being cynical. This daily headache in the opaque air of this tomb or jail is disturbing, but I must persevere. I've written more than 100 pages and not got anywhere yet. My calendar's getting confused. That must have been around August 15th, 1947. Oh, I don't think I can go on. Heart, head, everything. Lolita, 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 Lolita. Repeat until the page is full, printer. Still in Parkington. Finally, I did achieve an hour's slumber, from which I was aroused by gratuitous and horribly exhausting congress with a small hairy hermaphrodite, a total stranger. By then it was 6 in the morning, and it suddenly occurred to me it might be a good thing to arrive at the camp earlier than I'd said. From Parkington I still had 100 miles to go, and there would be more than that to the hazy hills and Bryceland. If I'd said I'd come for Dolly in the afternoon, it was only because my fancy insisted on merciful night falling as soon as possible upon my impatience. But now I foresaw all kinds of misunderstandings and was all a-jitter lest delay might give her the opportunity of some idle telephone call to Ramsdale. However, when at 9:30 a.m. I attempted to start, I was confronted by a dead battery, and noon was nigh when at last I left Parkington. I reached my destination around 2:30, parked my car in a pine grove, where a green-shirted, red-headed, impish lad stood throwing horseshoes in sullen solitude, was laconically directed by him to an office in a stucco cottage, in a dying state, had to endure for several minutes the inquisitive commiseration of the camp mistress, a sluttish, worn-out female with rusty hair. Dolly, she said, was all packed and ready to go. She knew her mother was sick, but not critically. Would Mr. Hayes, I mean Mr. Humbert, care to meet the camp councillors? Or look at the cabins where the girls live? Each dedicated to a Disney creature? Or visit the lodge? Or should Charlie be sent over to fetch her? The girls were just finishing fixing the dining room for a dance. And perhaps afterwards she would say to somebody or other, "The poor guy looked like his own ghost." Let me retain for a moment that scene in all its trivial and fateful detail. Hag Holmes, writing out a receipt, scratching her head, pulling a drawer out of her desk, pouring change into my impatient palm, then neatly spreading a banknote over it with a bright "and five," photographs of girl children, some gaudy moth or butterfly, still alive, safely pinned to the wall, nature study, the framed diploma of the camp's dietitian, my trembling hands, a card produced by efficient Holmes with a report of Dolly Hayes's behaviour for July, fair to good, keen on swimming and boating, a sound of trees and birds and my pounding heart. I was standing with my back to the open door, and then I felt the blood rush to my head as I heard her respiration and voice behind me. She arrived, dragging and bumping her heavy suitcase. "Hi," she said, and stood still, looking at me with sly, glad eyes, her soft lips parted in a slightly foolish but wonderfully endearing smile. Let me explain. I was not unduly disturbed by her self-accusatory innuendos. I was still firmly resolved to pursue my policy of sparing her purity by operating only in the stealth of night, only upon a completely anaesthetized little nude. Restraint and reverence were still my motto, even if that purity, incidentally thoroughly debunked by modern science, had been slightly damaged through some juvenile erotic experience, no doubt homosexual, at that accursed camp of hers. Of course, in my old-fashioned, old-world way, I, Jean-Jacques Humbert, had taken for granted when I first met her that she was as unravished as the stereotypical notion of a normal child had been since the lamented end of the ancient world B.C. and its fascinating practices. We are not surrounded in our enlightened era by little slave flowers that can be casually plucked between business and bath, as they used to be in the days of the Romans. And we do not, as dignified Orientals did in still more luxurious times, use tiny entertainers fore and aft between the mutton and the rose sherbet. The whole point is that the old link between the adult world and the child world has been completely severed nowadays by new customs and new laws. Despite my having dabbled in psychiatry and social work, I really knew very little about children. After all, Lolita was only 12, and no matter what concessions I made to time and place, even bearing in mind the crude behaviour of American schoolchildren, I still was under the impression that whatever went on among those brash brats went on at a later age and in a different environment. Therefore, to retrieve the thread of this explanation, the moralist in me bypassed the issue by clinging to conventional notions of what 12-year-old girls should be. The child therapist in me, a fake, as most of them are, but no matter, regurgitated neo-Freudian hash and conjured up a dreaming and exaggerating dolly in the latency period of girlhood. Finally, the sensualist in me, a great and insane monster, had no objection to some depravity in his prey. But somewhere behind the raging bliss, bewildered shadows conferred. And not to have heeded them, this is what I regret. Human beings, attend! I should have understood that Lolita had already proved to be something quite different from innocent Annabelle, and that the nymphian evil breathing through every pore of the fey child that I had prepared for my secret delectation would make the secrecy impossible and the delectation lethal. I should have known, by the signs made to me by something in Lolita, the real child Lolita or some haggard angel behind her back, that nothing but pain and horror would result from the expected rapture. Oh, winged gentleman of the jury! And she was mine. She was mine. The key was in my fist was in my pocket, she was mine. In the course of the evocations and schemes to which I had dedicated so many insomnias, I had gradually eliminated all the superfluous blur, and by stacking level upon level of translucent vision had evolved a final picture.
End of disc four.
She was thinner and taller, and for a second it seemed to me her face was less pretty than the mental imprint I had cherished for more than a month. Her cheeks looked hollowed, and too much lentigo camouflaged her rosy, rustic features. And that first impression, a very narrow human interval between two tiger heartbeats, carried the clear implication that all Widower Humbert had to do, wanted to do, or would do, was to give this wan-looking, though sun-coloured little orphan, aux yeux battus. And even those plumbaceous umbrae under her eyes bore freckles. A sound education, a healthy and happy girlhood, a clean home, nice girlfriends of her age, among whom, if the fates deigned to repay me, I might find perhaps a pretty little Magdalene for Herr Dr. Humbert alone. But in a wink, as the Germans say, the angelic line of conduct was erased, and I overtook my prey. Time moves ahead of our fancies, and she was my Lolita again. In fact, more of my Lolita than ever. I let my hand rest on her warm, auburn head and took up her bag. She was all rose and honey, dressed in her brightest gingham with a pattern of little red apples, and her arms and legs were of a deep golden brown, with scratches like tiny dotted lines of coagulated rubies, and the ribbed cuffs of her white socks were turned down at the remembered level. And because of her childish gait, or because I had memorized her as always wearing heelless shoes, her saddle oxfords looked somehow too large and too high-heeled for her. Goodbye, Camp Q. Merry Camp Q. Goodbye, plain unwholesome food. Goodbye, Charlie boy. In the hot car, she settled down beside me, slapped a prompt fly on her lovely knee, then, her mouth working violently on a piece of chewing gum, she rapidly cranked down the window on her side and settled back again. We sped through the striped and speckled forest. "How's Mother?" she asked dutifully. I said the doctors did not quite know yet what the trouble was. Anyway, something abdominal.
Abominable?
No, abdominal. We would have to hang around for a while. The hospital was in the country, near the gay town of Leppingville, where a great poet had resided in the early 19th century, and where we would take in all the shows. She thought it a peachy idea and wondered if we could make Leppingville before 9 p.m. "We should be in Bryceland by dinner-time," I said, "and tomorrow we'll visit Leppingville. How was the hike? Did you have a marvellous time at the camp?"
"Uh-huh."
"Sorry to leave?"
"Uh-uh."
"Talk low. Don't grunt. Tell me something."
"What thing, Dad?"
She let the word expand with ironic deliberation. "Any old thing."
"Okay, if I call you that?"
Eyes slit at the road. "Quite."
"It's a sketch, you know. When did you fall for my mummy?"
Someday, Lo, you will understand many emotions and situations, such as, for example, the harmony and the beauty of spiritual relationship.
Bah!
Said the cynical nymphette. Shallow lull in the dialogue, filled with some landscape.
Look, Lo, at all those cows on that hillside. I think I'll vomit if I look at a cow again.
You know, I missed you terribly, Lo.
I did not. Fact, I've been revoltingly unfaithful to you. But it does not matter one bit, because you've stopped caring for me anyway. You drive much faster than my mummy, mister.
I slowed down from a blind 70 to a purblind 50. Why do you think I've ceased caring for you, Lo?
Well, you haven't kissed me yet, have you?
Inly dying, inly moaning, I glimpsed a reasonably wide shoulder of road ahead and bumped and wobbled into the weeds. Remember, she's only a child. Remember, she is only...
Hardly had the car come to a standstill than Lolita positively flowed into my arms. Not daring let myself go, not even daring let myself realize that this sweet wetness and trembling fire was the beginning of the ineffable life which, ably assisted by fate, I had finally willed into being. Not daring really to kiss her, I touched her hot opening lips with the utmost piety. Tiny sips, nothing salacious. But she, with an impatient wriggle, pressed her mouth to mine so hard that I felt her big front teeth and shared in the peppermint taste of her saliva. I knew, of course, it was but an innocent game on her part, a bit of backfish foolery in imitation of some simulacrum of fake romance. And since, as the psychotherapist as well as the rapist will tell you, the limits and rules of such girlish games are fluid, or at least too childishly subtle for the senior partner to grasp, I was dreadfully afraid I might go too far and cause her to start back in revulsion and terror. And, as above all, I was agonizingly anxious to smuggle her into the hermetic seclusion of the enchanted hunters, and we had still 80 miles to go, blessed intuition broke our embrace a split second before a highway patrol car drew up alongside. Florid and beetle-browed, its driver stared at me.
"Happened to see a blue sedan, same make as yours, pass you before the junction?"
"Why, no."
"We didn't," said Lo, eagerly leaning across me, her innocent hand on my legs. "But are you sure it was blue? Because
the cop, what shadow of us was he after, gave the little Colleen his best smile and went into a U-turn. We drove on.
"The fruit head," remarked Lo. "He should have nabbed you."
"Why me, for heaven's sake?"
"Well, the speed in this bum state is 50, and no, don't slow down, you dull bulb. He's gone now."
"We still have quite a stretch," I said, "and I want to get there before dark, so be a good girl."
Bad girl," said Lo comfortably. "Juvenile delinquent, but frank and fetching. That light was red. I've never seen such driving."
We rolled silently through a silent townlet.
"Say, wouldn't Mother be absolutely mad if she found out we were lovers?"
"Good Lord, Lo, let us not talk that way."
"But we are lovers, aren't we?"
"Not that I know of. I think we're going to have some more rain. Don't you want to tell me of those little pranks of yours in camp?"
"You talk like a book, Dad."
"What have you been up to? I insist you tell me."
"Are you easily shocked?"
"No. Go on."
"Let us turn into a secluded lane and I'll tell you."
"Lo, I must seriously ask you not to play the fool." "Well?"
"Well, I joined in all the activities that were offered."
"Ensuite?"
"And suet. I was taught to live happily and richly with others and develop a wholesome personality, be a cake, in fact."
"Yes, I saw something of the sort in the booklet."
"We loved the sings around the fire in the big stone fireplace or under the darn stars, where every girl merged her own spirit of happiness with the voice of the group."
"Your memory is excellent, Lo, but I must trouble you to leave out the swear words. Anything else?"
"The Girl Scouts' motto," said Lo rhapsodically, "is also mine. I fill my life with worthwhile deeds such as, oh, well, never mind what. My duty is to be useful. I am a friend to male animals. I obey orders. I am cheerful."
That was another police car.
"I am thrifty, and I am absolutely filthy in thought, word, and deed."
"Now, I do hope that's all, you witty child."
"Yep, that's all. No, wait a sec. We baked in a reflector oven. Isn't that terrific?"
"Well, that's better."
"We washed zillions of dishes. Zillions, you know, is schoolmarm slang for many, 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 many. Oh, yes, last but not least, as Mother says, now let me see, what was it? I know. We made shadowgraphs. Gee, what fun.
C'est bien tout?
Say, except for one little thing, something I simply can't tell you without blushing all over.
Will you tell me later?
If we sit in the dark and you let me whisper, I will. Do you sleep in your old room or in a heap with Mother?
Old room. Your mother may have to undergo a very serious operation, Lo.
Stop at that candy bar, will you, said Lo.
Sitting on a high stool, a band of sunlight crossing her bare brown forearm, Lolita was served an elaborate ice cream concoction topped with synthetic syrup. It was erected and brought her by a pimply brute of a boy in a greasy bow tie who eyed my fragile child in her thin cotton frock with carnal deliberation. My impatience to reach Bryceland and the enchanted hunters was becoming more than I could endure. Fortunately, she dispatched the stuff with her usual alacrity. "How much cash do you have?" I asked. "Not a cent," she said sadly, lifting her eyebrows, showing me the empty inside of her money purse. "This is a matter that will be amended in due time," I rejoined archly. "Are you coming?"
"Say, I wonder if they have a washroom."
"You are not going there," I said firmly. "It's sure to be a vile place. Do come on." She was, on the whole, an obedient little girl, and I kissed her in the neck when we got back into the car.
"Don't do that," she said, looking at me with unfeigned surprise. "Don't drool on me, you dirty man."
She rubbed the spot against her raised shoulder. "Sorry," I murmured. "I'm rather fond of you, that's all." We drove under a gloomy sky, up a winding road, and then down again.
"Well, I'm also sort of fond of you," said Lolita in a delayed, soft voice, with a sort of sigh, and sort of settled closer to me. "Oh, my Lolita, we shall never get there."
Dusk was beginning to saturate pretty little Bryceland, its phony colonial architecture, curiosity shops, and imported shade trees, when we drove through the weakly lighted streets in search of the enchanted hunters. The air, despite a steady drizzle beating it, was warm and green, and a queue of people, mainly children and old men, had already formed before the box office of a movie house, dripping with jewel fires.
"Oh, I want to see that picture. Let's go right after dinner. Oh, let's!"
"We might," chanted Humbert, knowing perfectly well the sly tumescent devil that by nine, when his show began, she would be dead in his arms.
"Easy," cried Lo, lurching forward, as an accursed truck in front of us, its backside carbuncles pulsating, stopped at a crossing.
If we did not get to the hotel soon, immediately, miraculously, in the very next block, I felt I would lose all control over the haze jalopy with its ineffectual wipers and whimsical brakes. But the passers-by I applied to for directions were either strangers themselves or asked with a frown, "Enchanted what?" as if I were a madman. Or else they went into such complicated explanations with geometrical gestures, geographical generalities, and strictly local clues.
"Then bear south after you hit the courthouse,"
that I could not help losing my way in the maze of their well-meaning gibberish. Lo, whose lovely prismatic entrails had already digested the sweetmeat, was looking forward to a big meal and had begun to fidget. As to me, although I had long become used to a kind of secondary fate, McFate's inept secretary, so to speak, pettily interfering with the boss's generous, magnificent plan, to grind and grope through the avenues of Bryceland was perhaps the most exasperating ordeal I had yet faced. In later months, I could laugh at my inexperience when recalling the obstinate boyish way in which I had concentrated upon that particular inn with its fancy name, for all along our route countless motor courts proclaimed their vacancy in neon lights, ready to accommodate salesmen, escaped convicts, impotents, family groups, as well as the most corrupt and vigorous couples. Ah, gentle drivers, gliding through summer's black nights, what frolics, what twists of lust you might see from your impeccable highways if comfy cabins were suddenly drained of their pigments and became as transparent as boxes of glass. The miracle I hankered for did happen after all. A man and a girl, more or less conjoined in a dark car under dripping trees, told us we were in the heart of the park, but had only to turn left at the next traffic light and there we would be. We did not see any next traffic light. In fact, the park was as black as the sins it concealed, but soon after falling under the smooth spell of a nicely graded curve, the travellers became aware of a diamond glow through the mist. Then a gleam of lake water appeared, and there it was, marvellously and inexorably under spectral trees at the top of a gravel drive, the pale palace of the enchanted hunters. A row of parked cars, like pigs at a trough, seemed at first sight to forbid access. But then, by magic, a formidable convertible, resplendent, rubious in the lighted rain, came into motion, was energetically backed out by a broad-shouldered driver, and we gratefully slipped into the gap it had left. I immediately regretted my haste, for I noticed that my predecessor had now taken advantage of a garage-like shelter nearby, where there was ample space for another car. But I was too impatient to follow his example.
"Wow, look swank," remarked my vulgar darling, squinting at the stucco as she crept out into the audible drizzle, and with a childish hand tweaked loose the frock fold that had stuck into the peach cleft, to quote Browning.
Under the arc lights, enlarged replicas of chestnut leaves plunged and played on white pillars. I unlocked the trunk compartment. A hunchbacked and hoary negro in a uniform of sorts took our bags and wheeled them slowly into the lobby. It was full of old ladies and clergymen. Lolita sank down on her haunches to caress a pale-faced, blue-freckled, black-eared cocker spaniel swooning on the floral carpet under her hand, as who would not, my heart, while I cleared my throat through the throng to the desk. There, a bald, porcine old man, everybody was old in that old hotel, examined my features with a polite smile, then leisurely produced my garbled telegram, wrestled with some dark doubts, turned his head to look at the clock, and finally said he was very sorry he had held the room with the twin beds till 6:30, and now it was gone. A religious convention, he said, had clashed with a flower show in Briceland, and the name, I said coldly, is not Humbug and not Humbug, but Herbert, I mean Humbert. And any room will do, just put in a cot for my little daughter, she is 10 and very tired. The pink old fellow peered good-naturedly at Lo, still squatting, listening in profile, lips parted to what the dog's mistress, an ancient lady swathed in violet veils, was telling her from the depths of the cretonne easy chair. Whatever doubts the obscene fellow had, they were dispelled by that blossom-like vision. He said he might still have a room, had one, in fact, with a double bed. As to the cot, Mr. Potts, do we have any cots left? Potts, also pink and bald, with white hairs growing out of his ears and other holes, would see what could be done. He came and spoke while I unscrewed my fountain pen, impatient Humbert.
Our double beds are really triple, Potts cosily said, tucking me and my kid in. One crowded night we had three ladies and a child, like yours, sleep together. I believe one of the ladies was a disguised man. However, would there be a spare cot in 49, Mr. Swine?
I think it went to the swoon, said Swine, the initial old clown.
We'll manage somehow, I said. My wife may join us later, but even then I suppose we'll manage.
The two pink pigs were now among my best friends. In the slow, clear hand of crime, I wrote Dr. Edgar H. Humbert and daughter, 342 Lawn Street, Ramsdale. A key, 342, was half shown to me, magician showing object he is about to palm, and handed over to Uncle Tom. Lo, leaving the dog as she would leave me some day, rose from her haunches. A raindrop fell on Charlotte's grave. A handsome young negress slipped open the elevator door, and the doomed child went in, followed by her throat-clearing father and crayfish Tom with the bags. Parody of a hotel corridor. Parody of silence and death.
"Say, it's our house number," said cheerful Lo.
There was a double bed, a mirror, a double bed in the mirror, a closet door with mirror, a bathroom door, ditto, a blue dark window, a reflected bed there, the same in the closet mirror. Two chairs, a glass-topped table, two bed tables, a double bed. A big panel bed, to be exact, with a Tuscan rose chenille spread, and two frilled, pink-shaded night lamps left and right. I was tempted to place a $5 bill in that sepia palm, but thought the largesse might be misconstrued, so I placed a quarter and added another. He withdrew. Click. Enfin, seul.
"Are we to sleep in one room?" said Lo, her features working in that dynamic way they did, not cross or disgusted, though plain on the brink of it, but just dynamic, when she wanted to load a question with violent significance.
"I asked them to put in a cot, which I'll use if you like."
"You're crazy," said Lo. "Why, my darling?" "Because, my darling, when darling mother finds out, she'll divorce you and strangle me."
"Just dynamic." "Not really taking the matter too seriously. Now, look here," I said, sitting down. while she stood a few feet from me and stared at herself contentedly, not unpleasantly surprised at her own appearance, filling with her own rosy sunshine the surprised and pleased closet door mirror. "Look here, Lo, let's settle this once for all. For all practical purposes, I am your father. I have a feeling of great tenderness for you. In your mother's absence, I am responsible for your welfare. We are not rich, and while we travel, we shall be obliged. We shall be thrown a good deal together. Two people sharing one room inevitably enter into a kind of, The word is incest, said Lo, and walked into the closet. Walked out again with a young golden giggle, opened the adjoining door, and after carefully peering inside with her strange smoky eyes, lest she make another mistake, retired to the bathroom. I opened the window, tore off my sweat-drenched shirt, changed, checked the pill vial in my coat pocket, unlocked that she drifted out. I tried to embrace her, casually, a bit of controlled tenderness before dinner. She said, "Look, let's cut out the kissing game and get something to eat." It was then that I sprang my surprise. Oh, what a dreamy pet. She walked up to the open suitcase as if stalking it from afar, at a kind of slow-motion walk, peering at that distant treasure box on the luggage support. Was there something wrong, I wondered, with those great grey eyes of hers, or were we both plunged in the same enchanted mist? She stepped up to it, lifting her rather high-heeled feet rather high, and bending her beautiful boy knees while she walked through the dilating space with the lentor of one walking under water or in a flight dream. Then she raised by the armlets a copper-coloured, charming and quite expensive vest, very slowly stretching it between her silent hands, as if she were a bemused bird hunter holding his breath over the incredible bird he spreads out by the tips of its flaming wings. Then, while I stood waiting for her, she pulled out the slow snake of a brilliant belt and tried it on. Then she crept into my waiting arms, radiant, relaxed, caressing me with her tender, mysterious, impure, indifferent twilight eyes, for all the world like the cheapest of cheap cuties. For that is what nymphets imitate, while we moan and die. "What's the cutter with missus?" I muttered, word control gone into her hair. "If you must know," she said, "you do it the wrong way." "Show white ray." "All in good time," responded the spooneret. "Siva ascendis, pulsata brulans, kitsulans, dementissima, elevator clatterans, pausa, clatterans, populus in corridoro, hanc nisi mors mihi adimit nemo, juncia puellula, jo pensavo fondissime, nob serva nihil quidquam." But of course, in another moment, I might have committed some dreadful blunder. Fortunately, she returned to the treasure box. From the bathroom, where it took me quite a time to shift back into normal gear for a humdrum purpose, I heard, standing, drumming, retaining my breath, my Lolita's oohs and gees of girlish delight. She had used the soap only because it was sample soap. "Well, come on, my dear, if you're as hungry as I am." And so to the elevator, daughter swinging her old white purse, father walking in front, nota bene, never behind, she is not a lady. As we stood now side by side, waiting to be taken down, she threw back her head, yawned without restraint, and shook her curls. "When do they make you get up at that camp?"
"Half past," she stifled another yawn, "6.
Yawn in full with a shiver of all her frame.
"Half past," she repeated, her throat filling up again.
The dining room met us with a smell of fried fat and a faded smile. It was a spacious and pretentious place with maudlin murals depicting enchanted hunters in various postures and states of enchantment amid a medley of pallid animals, dryads and trees. A few scattered old ladies, 2 clergymen, and a man in a sports coat were finishing their meals in silence. The dining room closed at 9, and the green-clad poker-faced serving girls were happily in a desperate hurry to get rid of us.
"Does he not look exactly, but exactly, like Quilty?"
said Lo in a soft voice,
her sharp brown elbow not pointing but visibly burning to point, at the lone diner in the loud checks in the far corner of the room. But like our fat Ramsdale dentist, Lo arrested the mouthful of water she'd just taken and put down her dancing glass.
"Course not," she said with a splutter of mirth. "I meant the writer fellow in the Dromes ad."
Oh, fame. Oh, femina.